So as was mentioned in the prayer, we're kind of in the middle of Vacation Bible School, and because of that, all the kids' classrooms are all full of things for this week, and so as is per tradition, we put everybody in here together, and I teach kind of a class that is associated with the topic of VBS. So the topic of VBS this year is the miracles of Jesus, and one of the things that is so impressive about Jesus is the fact that his miracles are unlike anything you would expect if man were to try and prove to you he was from God. If you remember, you go to the book of Acts, and you get to about Acts chapter 8, and there's a story of Simon the Magician. And Simon the Magician was a man who was out there performing different miracles. I put that in quotes because they weren't real, but they were just, just tricks, what we would think of as like magic tricks today. And there were a lot of people believing him and that he was the great power of God. And then when he saw Philip, and Philip was performing actual miracles, Simon could tell the difference. He left it behind and he said, I need to follow Philip and his teachings. The reason is because the way that man does things when he's trying to trick you is very different than the way God does it when he's trying to give you evidence. And that's exactly what Jesus shows us in his miracles, in how he performs them and where he performs them and when and all those sorts of details, is that he was not from man. Everything about him was testable. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 20 and 21 tells us not to despise prophecies. It says, do not despise prophecies. But it also then says right after that, test all things. So you have this twofold thing. If somebody actually has a message from God, listen to it. And it's important to listen to it. Don't ignore an actual message from God. That's a big deal. But on the other hand, test all things to make sure that they're actually from God, not just somebody saying they have a message from God. And it has really always been that way. Throughout the Bible, you read this picture that God gives of, come, let us reason together. That's one of my favorite quotes from Isaiah. Isaiah 1, verse 18, he says, come, let us reason together. God is more than happy to have his ways scrutinized and to have us to look at the evidence. And he provides evidence. For example, you think of like Romans chapter 1, verse 20, it talks about God's invisible attributes are clearly seen in the creation. God built the world in a way that it would be testable, and with a reasonable mind, you could look at the evidence of the creation and say there has to be a designer behind this. It has to be created. And it's because he gave us that evidence. And so here is God, he says, I am invisible. You can't see me. If you would see me, you would die. But I'll give you plenty of evidence that I exist. He's a big fan of evidence, even in the Old Testament. You think about back in the Old Testament, if somebody was indicted of a crime, and you take them to court, and you say, okay, we believe that so-and-so did this, they stole this thing, or they committed murder, or whatever it was, could you just put them in prison just because you said so? What did the Old Testament law require? Yeah, witnesses, two or three witnesses. And God even says in Deuteronomy 19, he says, if you only have one witness, that's not enough evidence, ignore it. Well, that comes from his character. In other words, he's a God that understands that it is fair to expect evidence and to not just take something at somebody's word. Deuteronomy 18, if you look over there, is an interesting passage in the Old Testament about God teaching on prophets in general. And all of this leads up to Christ, because if God is a God of evidence who says, come, let us reason together, then it should be reasonable to believe that Jesus is the Christ. There should be some reason and evidence for it. And that really comes down to the miracles. In Deuteronomy 18, when laying out the law for the Jews, God had told them that they should not ignore a prophet. In fact, he mentions in verse 18 of chapter 18. He says, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren. He'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. That's actually referring to Jesus. So he's been talking about prophets. He specifically says, I'm going to send a prophet someday, and I'm going to put my words in his mouth. And that's in preparation of Jesus. And then he goes down to verse 21. And he asks the question that he knows that they as human beings will ask at some point. He says, and if you say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? So he tells them, okay, pay attention to a true prophet, but a false prophet, ignore. And so that you, he says, if you say in your heart, how will we know the difference? How do I know the difference between a man who says, I have a message from God, and he actually does, and somebody who says, I have a message from God, and he's a charlatan? How do you know? And then he says in verse 22, when a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. So really, he says, okay, if anybody's going to claim to be a prophet, take some of the things that he said. Do they actually come true? Has he shown you something that gives evidence that he has supernatural and divine knowledge? If so, you need to listen to him. But if it all falls apart, you know, like the prophecies of Nostradamus or something like that, where somebody says, I think this will happen, or you know, in the news every once in a while somebody say, the end of the world will be on such and such a date, and then that date comes, and then the next day, what do you think about the guy? Well, don't worry about him. He didn't know what he's talking about. God says it is fair for us to expect evidence, and it's fair and reasonable for us to test these things. So that brings us to then, of course, Jesus. Because Jesus was born on this earth just like anybody else. I understand that the beginning of the story is a little unique. But, you know, he grew up in Nazareth, and even in the people that knew him, when he came back to preach, they said, isn't this Joseph's son? Isn't this the carpenter's son? I mean, he was a normal person. Why should we listen to him? Well, Matthew chapter 4 gives us a really good picture of what it was like to be around Jesus and the sort of evidence that he provided. In Matthew chapter 4, down in verse 23, right before Jesus is going to give the Sermon on the Mount, the last part of the chapter, starting in verse 23, gives us a very good picture of what it was like as Jesus went about preaching. It says, and Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. And his fame went throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, and epileptics, and paralytics, and he healed them. Great multitudes followed him from Galilee, from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. Now the Holy Spirit put these words in here for a reason, so that you and I could look and see, well, what was it like as Jesus went about preaching? What sort of miracles did he perform? And look at the language there. All kinds of sickness, all kinds of diseases. They brought to him all sick people. They came from all different places, from the Decapolis, Galilee, Jerusalem, Judea, beyond the Jordan. There were various diseases and torments that they were afflicted with, demon possession, epileptics, paralytics. So you have this big, broad list of people. And so what that does is that sets Jesus apart. Because throughout history, there have always been Simon the Magicians. There have always been these people who have said that they are the great power of God. In modern American history, they've typically called themselves faith healers. And they'll hold a meeting, and they'll tell, they used to hold tent meetings where they'd go out and have a giant tent that they set up, and people would come on such and such a day, and they would supposedly heal people of various diseases. Today they don't really do it in tents. Now they'll rent a stadium or some convention center, do the same type of thing, and then say, come on such and such a day, and there will be these healings. You know, Benny Hinn is one that's fairly well known for that sort of thing. today. Oral Roberts was somebody, he's gone now, but he was pretty famous for that sort of thing before. And they would profess, we can heal people. We are the great power of God. We have this power from God. So then we heal these people and now listen to our message. And the message that they would preach wouldn't match the Bible. And so what's the difference between them and Jesus? Well, there's something really unique about Jesus that sets him apart from any faith healer or Simon the magician or anybody of that sort that has ever walked the earth. Timing, setting, grouping, and types of sicknesses. When you look at, there have been books written by ex-faith healers, so they get out of the business at some point, and they say, this is how we do it. And there are certain things that have to, in order to get a crowd to buy into the idea that they had performed a miracle and that they should listen to them and give them all their money, because a lot of times the faith healers, at least in American history, that's kind of what went along with it, is give us all your money and God will bless you. See, look, we have this power to perform miracles. If you have faith, we'll do it. And so it was a good way to make money. Not a righteous way to make money, but it was a good financial scheme for those guys. And some of the ex-ones who have gotten out of it, they write books and they tell you there are certain things you have to do before you can get people to buy in to the picture that an actual miracle was performed. And one of those things is timing. You ever notice that with the faith healers, and when they talk about performing miracles, they don't just perform them on street corners? Well, you got to come to our meeting. Come to the stadium at this time, at this place. Come up on stage. Everything, it's just that time. You know, somebody asked Benny Hinn one time, he said, if you really can perform miracles, why are you going from stadium to stadium? Shouldn't you be going from hospital to hospital? And so there's a timing element to it. And then there's also a staging element to it. Just like a good magician, I mean, if you watch a David Copperfield or a Lance Burton, any of these great magicians who make a lot of money with their shows, what do they always have? They have music, they've got lights, they set the stage, they do things to get your attention drawn over here instead of over here. There's a whole setting that is involved with it that requires staging. And so that's another thing. You say, we only do it at a certain time. And if somebody says, well, why don't you do it now? You say, well, if you don't have the faith to wait, I don't know what to do for you. That's the way you handle that. You say, well, if you don't have the faith to wait, I can't heal you. And then you do it at a certain place, a certain time, controlled circumstances, and you only do it for a certain group of people. You notice when you look at the faith healers of America, they're not healing like war veterans who are amputees, are they? I lost my limb in the war. I was over in Afghanistan and somebody blew my leg off. Can you heal it? Did they ever do that? Now, it's always something that is what we would call like an internal injury. Somebody who has cancer, a lot of times that finds that you find out later they never actually had the cancer. It was just a fear of cancer. Interesting thing that the people who write, who used to be faith healers and then got out of the business, and that's how they talk about it too, I got out of the business, that they'll talk about is there's kind of two cons going on. There's we're conning the people, and then also there's a lot of times people who want to be sick so that they can be healed, and so they've got their own kind of con going on. They come up and they say, I've got cancer, when actually they had been told you might have cancer by their doctor, but that doesn't sound good on the stage, so they play it up. So you only do certain things, certain sicknesses, and only certain groups of people. You don't do it with a bunch of skeptics around. One of the first rules of being a faith healer, they tell you, is you've got to make sure that the audience is really bought into the idea first. You don't have a bunch of skeptics out there who are saying, I don't believe you. You wait until they're screaming amen and hallelujah. You wait until everybody's worked up into a fervor, and then at the very end, once everybody's emotions are all worked up and they're already excited and they're waiting and they want to see you perform a miracle, then you do it. But you don't do it when you have the skeptics out there. In fact, if you have the skeptics out there, what you do is you say, I'm getting a vision from God, and you go into the back and then you cancel the rest of the meeting. And they do that. They realize, oh, the crowd's not right. So only do certain types of sicknesses, only certain groups, only in certain settings and circumstances, and only certain timings. So here's the question. Is that how Jesus performed miracles? The interesting thing about Jesus is he breaks all of the rules of the con artist, all the Simon the magician rules, all the faith healers of the tent meetings, the televangelists, all those rules he breaks. Take, for example, Matthew chapter 8. We'll go to a couple of other places, but primarily we're going to stay here in Matthew. Matthew chapter 8. You go down to verse 16. In Matthew 8:16, it says, when evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. You look there in verse 16, how many of the sick people on that occasion did he heal? All who were sick. That's not the way you do it if you're a trickster. He heals all of the sick. So which of the sick did he not heal? Which of the sick did he say, you don't have enough faith, I'm not going to heal you? On that occasion, how many did he heal? I know it's dumb, but it's a little thing, but it's a big thing. He healed all the sick. And the interesting thing is, as you look at the account of Jesus and his miracles, this isn't just an account that was written later of all the arguments that were brought up against Jesus by the Jews. You know what? One argument was never brought up. They argued he's not the Christ. They argued he gets this power from Satan, from Beelzebul. Remember that? Where they said you cast out demons by the power of Beelzebul. They argued that he was a wicked man. They argued that he was crazy. They argued that he was a drunkard. But you know what they never, ever, 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 ever once argued? They never argued that he didn't actually perform miracles. Because his miracles were unlike anything else. They were so notable, so clear. When evening came, he healed all who were sick. Now, you compare that to the picture that you get from, say, Matthew 24. And in Matthew 24, Jesus warns, he says, for false Christs, Matthew 24, verse 24, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Jesus warned, there will always be people who try and deceive you, and they'll give you great signs and wonders, but what are the purpose of the great signs and wonders? The great signs and wonders are to deceive. Jesus, his miracles were done in such a way that there was no room for deception. People would bring their sick from all these different cities, and he'd heal all of them. He'd leave none undone. Go to Matthew chapter 9. Well, in Matthew chapter 9, you actually see three different miracles performed, one after the other. And each of them deals with these particular details of Jesus' timing and the settings in which he performed it and the groups of people and the types of sicknesses. In Matthew chapter 9, starting in verse 18, it says, while he spoke these things to them, behold, a ruler came and worshipped him, saying, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live. So Jesus arose and followed him, and so did his disciples. And suddenly, A woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years came from behind and touched the hem of his garment. Now, stop before we get any farther. Verse 20 starts with two words, and suddenly. That's the opposite of staging, isn't it? This is a surprising event. We're going to find it's a surprising event even to Jesus himself. Suddenly, all of a sudden, this happens. Where is Jesus going? He's going to this man's house to take care of his daughter that has died. And so he's traveling along. There's masses of people around him. He's walking along, and suddenly, no staging. The timing is unexpected. It says, she touched the hem of his garment, for she said to herself, if only I may touch his garment, I shall be made well. But Jesus turned around, and when he saw her, he said, be of good cheer, daughter, your faith has made you well. And the woman was made well from that hour. Now, other accounts of it point out that when Jesus turns around, before telling her, be of good cheer, your faith has made you well, he asks a question. Who touched my garment? I felt the power leave me. Who did it? You don't get much more unexpected than that, right? He didn't even know. If the whole point of a true miracle is to attest to the fact that this person is from God, that the power is from God and not from man. Well, is there any clearer picture that the power was from God than Jesus is walking along and he feels the power leave him, but it just happened? Who was in charge of performing that miracle? Jesus was just a conduit, wasn't he? Was he actively involved in that miracle? Not really. He's just more like a lightning rod. And she goes up, touches the hem of his garment, and she's healed. And Jesus afterwards says, who did that? So there wasn't that sort of staging with him. And so then from there, down in verse 23, he's on that journey to go and take care of that ruler's daughter. So verse 23 says, when Jesus came into the ruler's house and he saw the flute players and the noisy crowd wailing, these are the hired mourners. That's how they would do it in Eastern culture. They still do it in parts of the Middle East where they will hire people to mourn. You have somebody die, you hire mourners, and that's the way that you show very clearly to the whole world how much you miss this loved one. And so he said to them, make room, for the girl is not dead but sleeping. And they ridiculed him. But when the crowd was put outside, he went in and he took her by the hand, and the girl arose, and the report of this went out into all that land. Remember one of the other things I told you? Faith healers, the charlatans, they never do it unless the whole crowd's behind them already. Everybody's excited. We're waiting for the miracle. Was that the case with Jesus and this ruler's daughter? What did the crowd say when he said, she's not dead, she's only sleeping? Did they say, yes, hallelujah? They laughed at him. They did the opposite. They mocked him. They said, you don't know what you're talking about. And yet he performed the miracle anyway, even though the skeptics were right there. The skeptics were there to verify if he had made a mistake. If he had said, oh, she's not dead, she's only sleeping, and he had been wrong, how long would it have taken for the news to spread throughout all of Galilee that he was not really a miracle worker? It's just been instantaneous, right? It would have been immediate news that spread forth. And then you go down to verse 27, we have a third miracle that's performed. It says in verse 27, when Jesus departed from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, Son of David, have mercy on us. And when he came into the house, the blind men came to him and said to Jesus said to them, do you believe that I am able to do this? And they said to him, yes, Lord. And he touched their eyes, saying, according to your faith, let it be to you. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, saying, see that no one knows it. But when they had departed, they spread the news about him in all that country. So here's another one. These two blind men, and they have a illness, a disease, an infirmity that is not an inward one, is it? If you're blind, that's a pretty verifiable thing, isn't it? And Jesus is going to heal them of that. And then what does he tell them after he's healed them? He says, don't tell anybody. That's not what the faith healers do, is it? The whole point for them is work the crowd, get the fervor. We want everybody to know. We want to build excitement over this. Jesus performed miracles on many occasions where he was not interested in getting the credit for it at all. Don't tell anybody. Now, did the blind men listen? No. But that doesn't change the fact that that was what he told them. And so you have this picture even just in Matthew 9, where you look here and there's these three miracles performed in succession, and all of them go against the way you would do it unless you really did have power from God. Because if you're trying to deceive people, if you have great signs and wonders for deception, you have to be careful about how you do that. But if you actually have power from God and can actually perform miracles, does it really matter what circumstances you're in or who's watching or who's paying attention? How they feel about it? None of that matters. If you actually have the power, you've got the power. And that's exactly what Jesus had. He had the kind of power that was shocking. It wasn't just a power over man. It wasn't just a power over certain types of sicknesses. It wasn't just a power that he could only use in certain circumstances. If people had enough faith, or if people believed him and didn't ridicule him, it was one that transcended all of those sorts of typical things that you will see involved with people deceiving others. And then you go to Matthew 14. Now, Matthew chapter 14, start down at about verse 22. It says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. So his disciples, they send them on a boat to cross the Sea of Galilee. He stays behind to deal with the crowds. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. So several hours have gone by at this time, and his apostles have been on this boat crossing the Sea of Galilee. It says, when evening came, he was alone there, but the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. So I want you to view the scene. Here's the boat. They're trying to cross the water, and the kind of men that are rowing this boat are what type? I mean, what is the livelihood of quite a few of these apostles? They're fishermen, right? They know how to row a boat. They know how to get it across the water. And yet, hours have gone by and they've not crossed the Sea of Galilee yet. And the reason for that is because the weather's really, really bad. It's been very contrary. The waves have kicked up. The wind has kicked up. Now, what you're going to see next is Jesus, he's going to perform a miracle. He's going to walk on water. If you're a charlatan, do you wait for a storm or do you do it where the water's all placid and you can set the stage in a perfect scenario? See, people have tried to replicate it. Magicians have said, I can walk on water too. And they've tried to replicate what Jesus did. And they give examples of how you can make people think you're walking on water. But you know how it is? Every single time when they try and replicate Jesus' miracles through trickery, they always do it with calm water, a placid lake, at a specific time when they can control all the elements. Is that what's going on here? We have waves kicked up and wind and men out in a boat in a storm where it's very risky for their lives even. So Jesus, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, in verse 25, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a ghost. And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Here's another interesting thing. Jesus had created such a culture amongst his apostles that he could really do anything, that Peter is not afraid to test all things either. Remember how we started with the verse, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, don't despise prophecies, but test all things? Peter does that. Lord, if it's actually you, you command me to walk out on the water. It's not enough just to see you. So now he adds this other element to the whole thing, doesn't he? Now if you're a trickster, you find some way to joke it off. You wait till you get to the boat And then you show him that it's you. But instead, what does he say to Peter? Fine, come on out. Peter guts out. And he says, come. He says, when Peter come down of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Well, when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. So there's a couple of different things. One, Jesus could perform miracles. And then when Peter begins to come out, Peter starts to struggle with his faith and trust in God. So he begins to sink. And so all of a sudden he's starting to drown and he's worried. Well, does that affect Jesus? What does Jesus do? He reaches down and he pulls him up. I wonder what that looks like. Somebody standing on water, pulling somebody out of water. It's pretty impressive. And then you have another element added to it. As if it were not enough to walk on water, okay, let's prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is not some staged thing, that he doesn't somehow have, you know, pillars under the water or floaties on his shoes or some other sort of strange trickery, which is silliness. But let's prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. When they get on the boat, what happens? The wind stops. So it doesn't just control the water, it controls the wind. Now, if you go to the account in John chapter 6, down in verse 21, John adds another detail to it. He gets on the boat, the wind ceases, and immediately they're on the other side. Remember what those men have been doing all night? Rowing and rowing and rowing and stuck, and the wind and the water, and it's keeping them. These big, burly fishermen cannot make it across the water. It gets to the fourth watch of the night, and Jesus walks out to them on the water, and they still haven't made it across. He gets on the boat, and boom, they're there. Master of sea and sky and space and time. It's not the way man would trick you. Everything about the way Jesus performed miracles made it so that he was somebody unlike anybody who came before with deception. Because every culture has had magicians. In fact, we live in somewhat of a lovely golden time, thanks to Harry Houdini. Houdini is probably the most famous magician of all time, at least in our era. And Houdini was a guy that his mother died. And when she died, he was grief-stricken. And so at the depths of his mourning, he went to go see some of those fortune tellers who would hold a seance and you could speak to the dead, that sort of thing. But the problem was this: Houdini was a magician and he knew all of the tricks, so he went to the seance and guess what happened? He saw through all of their trickery. And so he began to educate the public. It made him so mad that somebody was preying upon his grief to make money that he went and made it a point to educate the public that magic is just trickery. It's fun, it's exciting, but it's all smoke and mirrors. It's not real. And that's why you and I live in an era where magicians, you don't worship magicians. You just go to a show and say, oh, that was fun. I wonder how they did that. Because you know and assume ahead of time it's a trick. And they tell you that. In fact, magicians now, a lot of them, they don't call themselves magicians. They call themselves illusionists. Because they want you to know it's an illusion that you just don't know how to figure out. Before Houdini, that was not the way it was. These guys who did this, they wanted to believe you to believe that they had the power of God. They wanted you to believe that they had actual magical dark arts. And so, historically, that's the way it's always been. And in other cultures, it's still that way. You go to different parts of Africa in particular, but also South America, it's fairly prominent as well. And there's a lot of belief in the occult, that it's an actual real power. Jesus came along with actual power so that people would not be deceived. And then the level of trust in that is so huge that by the time you get to the book of Acts, so turn over to Acts chapter 2. In Acts chapter 2, in verse 22, Peter tells us what the point of miracles was. Why did Jesus perform all these miracles? And in Acts chapter 2, verse 22, Peter says about Jesus, "Men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know." Now, in Peter's sermon, his very first gospel sermon, that's all he's going to mention about miracles. He's going to say, Jesus performed them because God, through him, performed those miracles to attest to Jesus. That is, the purpose of the miracles was so that you would know God is with Jesus, and whatever he says, listen to. Because if you go back to Matthew 4, where it talked about all the different diseases, all sicknesses, before he was healing the sicknesses, it says Jesus went about throughout all of Galilee preaching and teaching. And so Peter says he was attested by the signs which God did through him in your midst, that is, so that all of you could see. And then he says in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words, as you yourselves also know. He says, you know it. He doesn't even have to argue the point. He doesn't have to bring it up. They saw it. They were notable miracles. They were undeniable. They were done in an open and public fashion without any tricks up his sleeve or smoke or mirrors. And it was such a clear thing to the culture of that day that, like I said, when they brought up arguments about Jesus, because there are many Jews that did not follow Jesus, they brought up arguments like he's not the Son of God, or he did it because of the power of Beelzebub, or he's a glutton or a drunkard. He would bring up these sorts of arguments against him, but they never brought up the argument he never really performed a miracle. They never said he's a liar or a cheater. They said he was crazy. They said he got the power from a dark place, but they never said he didn't have the power because of the quality of miracles. And what happens then is Peter preaches all this sermon, and then at the very end of it, you get to Acts chapter 2, you get down to verse 36. And Peter, a man who had been there to see all of those miracles, he'd even been involved with some of them, like we just read, Peter, come on out to me on the water. Peter stands up, and in verse 36, he says in this lesson, he says, therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus whom you crucified both Lord and Christ. I want you to look at that, the way he says it there. I want all the house of Israel to know, and then he uses a word. I want them to know assuredly. How confident was Peter that Jesus was Lord and Christ? I want you to know assuredly, beyond any shadow of a doubt. I am sure of this. I am confident of it. And how confident was Peter? What would Peter eventually end up having to do for the gospel the same as all the other apostles? Die. He'd die for it. You don't die for a hunch. You don't die for something you kind of think might be true. He died knowing full well Jesus is the Christ because God had testified of him by those miracles, signs, and wonders. And Peter had seen them firsthand. He'd been close. Now, in our world, the people who are closest to the magician, do they believe the magic, or are they in on it? Most magicians, they have the beautiful woman that's the assistant, right? Does she know what's going on? Yeah, she does. Do you think she would, they said, if somebody came and put a gun to the assistant to David Copperfield and put a gun to her head and said, if it's real magic, are you willing to die for it? What do you think she'd do immediately? No! It's not real. It's all pretend. Here, I'll tell you how it's done. The men who were closest to Jesus, who would have seen the tricks when nobody else did, what did they say? You can know assuredly. I have no doubt in my mind. The closer you got to Jesus, The closer you got to his miracles, the closer you scrutinized it. I don't know about you, but when I watch magic shows, that's what I'm doing. I'm the guy who's looking as close as I can. They tell you to look over here, and I'm the guy who will actually block that part of the TV so I can look at the other. I'm not going to be distracted by whatever thing you got going on over here. I want to see what's going on. That's what the apostles were. They were the guys who saw every little detail, and their conclusion was real or false. Couldn't be more real. So real, I'll die for it. So real, I want you to know assuredly that Jesus is both the Lord and the Christ. And that is really the beautiful part about Jesus' miracles, is that you see it's undeniable. And the culture of that day, the people who were there, they saw it. They are the greatest living proof, because Jesus did these things publicly. It wasn't a private thing. His religion that he created, because Jesus expects a great deal out of us. And if somebody's going to expect a great deal out of you and ask you to do something and tell you they have the authority to, they should be able to prove it. Jesus proved it publicly, not privately. He didn't say, I have a private vision. You don't get to know about it. But just trust me, he did all of these things publicly. And the people of that day who saw those things publicly, they couldn't deny it. So much so that when Jesus' apostles came along and began performing miracles, they were the same sort of things were said about them. If you look over in Acts chapter 4, in Acts chapter 4, when Peter and John had been dragged before the Jewish high court, they had to try and figure out what to do with them. And it says in Acts 4, verse 16, that the council, they began to argue with each other about how to handle these guys. And it says, what shall we do to these men? For indeed that a notable miracle has been done through them is evident to all who dwell in Jerusalem. And we cannot deny it. That's what Israel of the first century said. These are real things, real miracles. We can't deny it. We don't like it. They didn't like what message Jesus came with, and so they would ignore it, but they couldn't deny it. And so it puts Jesus in a totally different category as far as miracles. No lying signs and wonders, no deception, all out in the open. Did anybody have any comments or questions before we shut down here for the evening? Okay, we'll shut down there, and we'll be back into Romans starting next week.